Hello, Radio Statler listeners. We have another interview for you. We're joined in the studio by Benjamin Dean. Benjamin, as I understand it, you just gave a talk a little earlier ago about Link NYC. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. We were initially supposed to have John Young and Deborah Natsios come in today and present. They run Cryptome.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure many of your listeners follow Cryptome.
Yep.
Cryptome, and probably have for the last 20 years. So they were meant to come in today and do a talk on Link NYC. It was entitled Link NYC Spy Stations. Something that's quite new in New York City is the construction of a network of, they call them links, they're kind of like these obelisks that sit in the street.
Okay.
They've got ads on either side of them, electronic ads, and then it provides nominally free Wi-Fi to New Yorkers.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, John and neither of the Cryptome team could come along to do the talk. They pulled out earlier this week, so
okay.
I've been following this for a while now, and I threw up my hand and said, you know, if you need someone to fill in, I'd be happy to come in and do it. So
sure.
That happened at 11 a.m. this morning, yeah.
Okay, so they're providing Wi-Fi, they're providing out in the public. What's the problem then, I guess?
So it's billed as free public Wi-Fi.
Right.
But as we know, with any service or product where it's free, you're not the customer, you're the product.
Right.
And when you actually start digging into it, it's nominally public Wi-Fi, but it's owned by a private consortium. So if you go back in time, around 2012, the administration decided they wanted to replace all of the payphones in the city.
Okay.
And so they put out a request for proposals, and the proposal that won, it was won by the same company that used to provide the payphones.
Gee, I wonder how that happened.
I know, it was a competitive process. And so they won the contract, and they had set up the designs, and they'd laid out the kind of grid on which they would install these 10,000 links.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day in mid-2015, Google created a new company called Sidewalk Labs. Sidewalk Labs is headed by the ex-deputy mayor of New York City. And Sidewalk Labs is kind of, in corporate speak, this smart cities company. This is when it kind of caught my attention. I was thinking to myself, well, what could they possibly be doing? Anyway, their first acquisition was of the two companies that, you know, had this contract for Link NYC. They bought the two companies, combined them together, called it Intersection. And then Intersection is part of the consortium that runs Link NYC called CityBridge. So it's like these corporate entities, each one owns the other one, like Russian dolls.
Right, right.
At the end of the, you know, the very big one is Google, and then the very center is CityBridge. And so I've been paying attention to this for a very long time. We know what Google's business model is.
Right.
We know it's about collecting personal information, targeting ads to people based on that information.
Right.
And so, of course, if you kind of put the two and two together, you would think, well, is that what they're going to do with this Link NYC system now that they own one of the companies in the consortium? So the talk today was to kind of delve into the details, because CityBridge has got a very active PR company that is,
right,
that is kind of their face to the public and to uh-huh. journalists. And they say a lot of things that when you take a closer look at how the contract is set up and you look at kind of what is actually happening under the surface, you,
right,
you see that there's a lot more to it than...
Has there been actually any solid indication of what they're doing with this data, or is it all speculation at this point?
At this point, it's a lot of speculation.
Okay.
So the privacy policy that they've laid out mm-hmm. says quite explicitly what data they may collect.
Okay.
There's MAC address, IP address,
right,
click stream, pages you've searched in the past. It says they may use that.
Okay.
It also has a bunch of other conditions around what they might use it for
mm-hmm.
and whom they might share it with. They're quite explicit. They won't sell the data to anyone.
Right.
They do say that they will share it with a whole lot of people whom they don't specify.
Right.
So all I hear anecdotally, and I mean, it says something that I have to get this anecdotally
mm-hmm.
in speaking with people. I'm told that they are not collecting all this information now, that the three cameras that are installed on each link terminal are not active. But it says quite clearly in the contracts that
right.
they're allowed to use them.
Right.
And they may use them in the future. They're just not going to tell us for what purpose specifically, right, and with whom the data is going to be shared.
So, I mean, free public Wi-Fi is not exactly a new thing. You know, there are the cable Wi-Fi, so the cable companies have banded together to provide a Wi-Fi in all of their devices that spreads out. And each of them also has their own. You know, Verizon has talked about doing something similar to this. You know, and multiple municipalities have decided to foot the bill in their cities to put up Wi-Fi access points. What do you see as the main difference between those efforts and Link NYC and what they're doing? Or is there a difference? Is it all kind of the same thing in your mind?
No, I think it's quite different. One of the big differences with the Link NYC system is the use of what they call kiosks, and I kind of call them totems or obelisks. They're these towers they're building in the streets. If you're using kind of typical Wi-Fi, you've got maybe a radius of 40 feet, 60 feet maybe. So instead of blanking the city, as a lot of the big telcos do with a signal from a tower, they're building on each block one of these obelisks. So the main difference is the installed infrastructure and the way in which the company that's doing the City Bridge is actually installing fiber in areas where there isn't fiber yet and connecting these terminals to that fiber.
Okay.
So as an extension of that point, one of the major differences is that City Bridge is investing a lot of money in this. They have two business models. One of them is where they offer to install these kiosks for the city. Mm-hmm. The city foots the bill for installing the kiosks and for maintaining them.
Right.
But they have no ads. There's another business model where there are ads, but City Bridge will foot the bill for that. And in this city, at least, they claim to be spending $300 million installing fiber, installing kiosks, nominally for free, because there are going to be ads associated with it.
Okay, so the question is, they're spending this money, where is it going? Whereas in the cable companies, it's already a sunk cost for them. They already have the infrastructure. They're just doing this out there. So they might not have the same incentive to make money off of their users' data.
Yes. I would actually posit the opposite. They claim to be drawing in $50 million in ad revenue over the next 12 years.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to split that 50-50 with the city. So that's $250 million to City Bridge from ads. Now, if you recall, I just said they're spending $300 million installing the things.
Right.
So that's strange because that means that they're running at a loss as of day one.
Right.
So the question I ask is, where are they going to get the money? The head of Sidewalk Labs, Dan Doktoroff, claims that they're going to make a whole lot of money out of this.
Mm-hmm.
If they're running at a loss as of day one, my question is, where is the money going to come from? And I suspect, and I've got a quote here from Dan that I used to kind of support this claim, I suspect that they're going to collect a lot of information over time, analyze it, and then use it to sell various other products and services either to the city or to other organizations. So the quote that I'll draw out here was in an excellent article that was recently published by Nick Pinto in The Village Voice. He does some excellent research on... He went out and interviewed a lot of experts, and he got a lot of great quotes. This is a quote here from Dan Doktoroff speaking at the Yale Club. It's always very interesting when someone's... The PR firm says, no, we're not collecting the information, we're just interested in the ads, and then kind of behind closed doors, the head of the company says something different. He says, by having access to the browsing activity of people using the Wi-Fi, all anonymized and aggregated, we can actually then target ads to people in proximity, and then obviously over time track them through lots of different things, like beacons and location services, as well as their browsing activity. So in effect, what we're doing is replicating the digital experience in physical space. So that sounds a lot like taking the business model of the internet, which is continuous tracking of users to target ads, and then applying it to meet space.
Right.
This seems to be where it's going, and we know the consequences of this online tracking.
Yep.
After 2013 and everything that Snowden revealed, we know the surveillance capabilities and the problems that arise because of that. And what it now looks like is for the next 10 years, this is the business model for the smart cities. And I think that there are a number of concerns, particularly around privacy, but also about who will be negatively impacted or disproportionately impacted by that surveillance, that have not been adequately addressed to this day. It's all very well to say we're going to provide free Wi-Fi in areas where people are disadvantaged and can't afford Wi-Fi access.
Right.
But they're the people who are disproportionately affected by surveillance.
Yeah.
So it seems like, you know, a strange bargain. We'll give you the free Wi-Fi that involves a lot of tracking, and you're precisely the people we want to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
And we're going to make sure we got cameras in these obelisks that we use to provide the internet. I find that problematic.
It's not hard to imagine a period, maybe 15 years from now, where, you know, we have a situation like in the Wire TV show, where they're sitting there and monitoring the Wi-Fi in the city to determine who's been sitting around all day in these places and be like, that's probably a drug dealer.
You can let your imagination run wild. I guess the point I try and make is that when you break down the numbers, if it's $500 million in ad revenue over 12 years, there's 10,000 links, and there's 8 million New Yorkers. If you break that down, it's like every month, if people were to pay a penny, we could install the same infrastructure.
Right.
We could provide free Wi-Fi that does not involve tracking and monitoring of people and does not involve putting up 30,000 ads, or I should say 20,000 ads, on these electronic billboards around the town. There are alternatives, and yet we don't hear of any. They're certainly technically possible. They're financially possible.
Right.
I wonder why they're not politically possible. It's an open question, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really interesting point, because, I mean, if you're looking at even something like this conference that builds a network out of nothing in a day and runs it between floors and has all of this stuff, and it's absolutely possible. It's absolutely possible to do it right. It's not the difficult part in my mind is doing it in such a way that you're not only doing the right thing morally and not tracking people, but also giving people the confidence that you really aren't doing it. And that's kind of, I think, the difficult part of this scenario.
Yeah. And I'm not a lawyer, but we had a lawyer on the panel this morning. Mm-hmm. When you look at the legal documents, they're written extremely vaguely. It's very opaque. So, I mean, to your point, how do you communicate to people that they can trust this stuff? Well, it starts with having very clear terms of use and privacy policies.
Right.
On the technical side, a lot of people, your regular person, really trusts the technical community to explain to them what is safe and what is not.
Right.
And right now, they're not getting the right information. They're at the, I guess, whatever the PR department at CityBridge says is what people have to go by.
Right.
And, you know, there are some serious issues that will come up, some consequences from this system, not just here, but as the company moves out. They're already planning to install it in Barcelona and cities across the United States. I mean, this is kind of the ground zero. This is the first time it's been done.
Right, right.
If we don't get it right here, then the consequences are going to be pretty serious.
So you mentioned that they have plans for Barcelona. Have the communications from them been positive, like they're succeeding at what they set out to do, or are they tempering their announcements and tempering the results, you know, their quarterly results and all of that?
I'm not really sure, to be honest. Part of the trouble is that the consortium itself doesn't release financials.
Okay.
So it's hard to actually have a look at that. It's also at a really early stage, so I think Barcelona's expressed an interest in doing something like this. But it's probably not advanced enough for us to actually say, you know, whether or not they're approaching it with apprehension or if
okay.
they're looking to do something different to what's happened here. It's a bit too early to say.
So what's the call to action here? You know, realistically, it seems unlikely that Link NYC is going to go away. What are the things that our listeners and the hacker community in general can do to change this, to make a change for the better here?
So you rightly point out here in New York City, it's a bit late, isn't it? But I point to other cities in the United States, and one of my slides today had it on there. I'd also point overseas. I mean, the hacker community is in kind of a trusted position as people who understand this technology inside and out. Not just the way it works, but the way in which it breaks. So actually informing people, helping people understand that this technology is not foolproof, that it has problems, it's going to have vulnerabilities, it's going to put people at risk in certain ways. Helping them understand that and then allowing them to make an informed choice, or at least put pressure on their elected representatives to actually, you know, address these issues, I think would be a big step forward, at least so as to avoid the missteps that have happened here in New York. That's what I would hope. One of the questions this morning, though, we had some excellent questions. Somebody asked about civil disobedience. You know, should you go up now and take a screwdriver to one of them? Or
right.
Put a sticker over the cameras? You know, I wouldn't condone going around and committing vandalism against these things. But that's... I'm thinking about ways in which you might have kind of non-violent resistance to this kind of system. Somebody kind of remarked, you know, use a condom. You know, use a VPN if you connect to the thing.
Right.
My approach is abstinence. Don't use it. I mean, public Wi-Fi is so insecure that, I mean, you're really taking a big risk whenever you use it, particularly if you're doing any sensitive activity.
Right.
I would really just say, if people feel the compulsion, like they have to be connected to this, it's their only option, then we need to make sure that they know what kind of VPN services they could use. There are many that are available for free, while they're not always as good as the paid for versions.
Right.
At least they know that there's an option out there to encrypt their information, thereby keep it safer. That's about as far as I see it. Unfortunately, this is kind of embedded in this larger political process, which for better or for worse is complicated and has checks and balances and moves slowly, precisely to avoid fools rushing in and making mistakes. And, you know, it seems to have failed us up until now.
Yes.
And this is, that's why the lesson is kind of a bigger picture one. And unfortunately, it has to be as vague as a big picture one.
And there's another point where our political system is very strongly focused at the top levels of government. You know, the federal government, the president, the Congress, people aren't paying, I think, enough attention to state and local legislatures where stuff like this happens on a pretty regular basis.
No, that's a great point, because these Wi-Fi systems are being rolled out on a city-to-city basis. And a few people came up to me after a talk on Friday night and said that they had actually run for, like, their local council member and had actually taken part in the process. Now, that's... Again, you know, you'll only get to have a look inside the system. But one of the people tweeted out today, we need more people in government who actually understand technology. I understand that it's an absolute pain to have to go and work in government, because I've done it. And it's slow, and it's bureaucratic. The problem is that the people who are in there right now making these decisions don't understand what they're doing. And so we end up with systems like this that have got so many inherent risks and drawbacks. When really, I feel like a more informed government, or at least providing information to them to help them make better decisions, might be better than crossing arms and saying, you know what, these people are idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. Let's just leave them to their own fate.
Right. Right.
Which is not what I'm saying is people are doing, but it's sometimes kind of the, well, we can't do anything, screw it approach. It's...
Nihilism has its downsides.
One of the only communities that actually knows what's going on is the hacker community.
Yeah.
You know, we saw this with the Apple and FBI thing, and this is the second crypto war and the first crypto war as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only when the hack community comes forward and starts explaining it to people, you know, why this is a terrible idea and why you should listen to us, that actually sometimes they're heard. I mean, that's one of the reasons the first crypto wars was won.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was this community, I think, has a voice more powerful than sometimes people realize.
Yeah.
And, it's a shame when people squander that opportunity to make real change.
Yeah, and it's a constant battle. You know, the second crypto war, all it takes is an FBI director to turn up and start talking about going dark.
Yep.
And we go back a decade. But I mean, fortunately, there are a few people. I'm affiliated with Columbia University, and there are a few professors up there who have been kind of on the front lines for these couple of decades. They're still there, but the more support they get, the more people they have who are spreading the word,
right,
better.
Right, absolutely. I mean, we saw it with SOPA and PIPA. We saw it with You know, the Apple FBI thing. I think we've seen a trend in the last decade or so that I've really been paying attention to this community of people realizing that they have a voice and that their voice actually matters in aggregate. And we see groups like Anonymous figuring that out. We see groups, you know, figuring out that hackers have a point of view that is unique and that people actually pay attention to. And it's one of the greatest things about this conference, as opposed to, I think, other hacker conferences where it's not just about exploits and security research and vulnerabilities, but it's about actually making social change, getting involved in the political system and changing things for the better.
Yeah. At least knowing that there is a voice. So many people feel completely atomized. And a lot of the people I spoke to earlier today were saying, you know, there's nothing we can do. If we try and kick out de Blasio, we'll just have him replaced with someone else who'll do the same thing. But if you look at Philadelphia right now in the Democratic National Convention, it was 2 days ago that WikiLeaks dumped the emails. And when you look in that information, you actually get to see the machinery behind the political process.
Right.
And it actually, there are people in the streets of Philadelphia right now, and they are pissed because they've finally gotten the information on how the political system works.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to condone hacking people's emails and dumping them on the internet, although I think that sometimes it has more benefits than people are willing to admit.
Yeah.
But there is potential here to actually create some change, or at least help inform people in a way in which helps them make better decisions than those that we see today, like NYC, Link NYC.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. But it's an unusual thing because, you know, I mentioned that Google is one of the owners of one of the companies in this consortium. And you mentioned SOPA PIPA before, and the net neutrality thing as well. I think it was late last year. It's interesting, it's strange bedfellows, because on the one hand, you've got companies like Google that collect so much information, deeply personal information on people. And at the same time, they're often the most ardent defenders of so many of kind of the ability to access information, keep the internet open. It's strange. I guess I would only say that anecdotally I've heard from people that are within these companies that I've mentioned, they're often astounded by the amount of information that is collected, sensitive information. And they always say to me, you know, if people stop trusting these companies with this information, that's it for the business model. That's
right.
It for the companies.
Right.
And so maybe that in a way is one way forward, and it's continually putting pressure on them and making sure we keep them accountable, because they would be scared as hell that
If people realized that they weren't doing the right thing by them.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And in this, what we've seen the media reaction here in New York around the Link NYC system. And in the times that there has been pushback, like around facial recognition, you go and look at the term, the privacy policy, and you see it tacked on there at the bottom. We will not use this for facial recognition. They're the kinds of things where you put a bit of pressure on them, you keep them honest, and you actually end up, Rambam's entered. Sorry, Rambam. It's my accent. I heard Rambam was talking about Link NYC yesterday. Yeah, we had a talk this morning on it. But I was just saying, put the pressure on them.
Right.
Make sure you keep them honest. I'll tell you, the hacker community, because they're so well informed, is probably one of the only communities that people should trust to know what they're talking about on technical issues. So,
yeah.
Welcome.
You're the Link New York City guy, right?
Sorry?
Did you speak at 11 o'clock this morning?
Yes, I did.
I told everybody to go to your class.
Thank you.
I put it up on the screen.
Yeah, it was a full room.
I purposely ended after 4 slides and said, go to this talk.
Great. No, it was for 11 a.m. on a Sunday. That's the turnout was packed, so
okay.
Thanks
very much.
Did you
suck, or were they happy they came?
I don't know. I got out of there alive,
okay.
So I assume that I didn't suck too bad. No lynch mobs.
This is a ferocious audience. Not only do they listen, they look carefully for every possible technical error. So if you go up there and you're a BS artist or you're a poser, you're dog meat.
That makes me feel a lot better then.
So if you got out alive without people, you know, hooting and hollering and saying you're full of crap, then then you must be a subject matter expert.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. But I will say that I've done two talks over the weekend. The questions have always been excellent, and it's because people are thinking two or three steps ahead.
Q&A is the best part.
Yeah.
Q&A is the best part. I mean, you give a talk here, and your IQ goes up 20 points. It's amazing.
Yeah. So how did your talk go yesterday?
I was terrible.
At least you didn't get arrested this time, though, right?
That's true.
That's always a good thing.
So right. So I'm always ahead of the game. No, it was all right. You know, I obviously, when you're talking about privacy and technological advances and new and interesting methods to suck information out of people's lives, every day there's a new advance in that. I mean, it's spy versus spy.
Yeah.
And between 2014, when I spoke here last, and 2016, it's a whole new world. Mm. I mean, just look at Pokemon Go.
Yeah.
I mean, besides the fact that that reports who you are, where you are, what you're doing, who you're doing it with, it's reporting it on 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 and 12-year-old kids.
Yep.
And
you know, some bunny burns.
Yeah. This sort of invasion of children's privacy and stalking children and tracking children would have been considered beyond the pale just a few years ago.
Yep.
I mean, it's okay if you gather information on adults. They're adults. They can actually sign a terms of service. They don't read it. They sign stupid terms of service, but they're adults. You know, this sort of new thinking about privacy and privacy being of no consequence, and you start shredding people's privacy and anonymity and ability to have, you know, open, free, unfiltered thought and discussion, you start screwing with people at 7, I mean, this is a new low. Mm. So I tried to get as much of that in as I could, and I couldn't.
Not enough time.
No, they're really not. They give me 3 hours, which is extraordinarily generous. Nobody can believe I don't fall on my face. and I'm actually pretty sick right now. I was sick yesterday. My nurse. Actually, not a joke, but I mean, I'm glad I got through the talk. I just wish I could have covered more.
Yeah. Well, the thing that astounds me with the Pokemon Go, it became evident to me very early on that the team that was running the thing clearly was, they're running on a shoestring. I mean, the thing...
Niantic?
How much
Niantic
money was invested
huge.
In them? How much money was in them?
Niantic has been around for a while.
Yeah.
And they are a spinoff of Google. Mm-hmm. And they provided products for the U.S. government. You know, right now in Russia, Pokemon Go is going to be banned as a security risk because they believe there's a CIA connection to it.
Aha, okay. I just inferred that because, you know, so quickly the servers crashed. And I think that's
evidence of the tenacity of gamers, more so than it is.
Okay, fair enough. I stand corrected.
So Nintendo's market cap went up $6 billion in 1 week. It became the most traded stock in the Tokyo Stock Exchange in history, ahead of Nippon Steel and God knows what. They are making $2 million a day on in-app purchases. That's why the service crashed, because the whole world is pokey freaking out. I mean, not because they're on a shoestring.
Uh-huh. Fair enough. I thought maybe a company so established would think through the kind of traffic that they're going to get, and even they got caught by surprise, huh? Because it was such an avalanche.
I'm sure they pressed the button, and now there's a few server farms of Google that are handling that. Or, look, it's not that hard to get servers. You can get. I mean, the CIA goes to Amazon. Anybody can go to Amazon.
That's why I was surprised that it crashed.
Well,
I mean,
the game
so
was based off of Ingress, and I'm pretty sure they probably thought that it would probably do just as well as Ingress, but I don't think they realized how well it was going to do.
Okay.
And I'm sure they just pretty much just went with Ingress, and they're like, all right, we'll go from there. Well, I mean, like any new game has this issue.
Yeah,
every single new
every,
game that
every
comes
game
out,
that comes
the
out.
The servers break right in the first day.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, personally, I think the game is moronic. I was standing behind the guy on the street yesterday in Manhattan. I could have taken his pants. I mean, he didn't even know he was there trying to flip a ball over a little monster, and then when he finally did it, the ball shot a laser beam and got the monster. And he was like, "Ugh." And I was standing this close to the guy, and the guy was oblivious. They had to put into the game that you can't hatch an egg if you're moving faster than 20 miles an hour. Because people were driving cars into people were driving cars into cop cars.
Yeah. There was a friend of mine who was, we were walking down 7th Avenue a little earlier, and we were walking to get food, and all of a sudden she just goes, "Bye!" and just runs off in a direction. I'm like, all right, well, that's a thing. You have to keep people from running into intersections. It's nuts.
It was funny because a few weeks ago, Tesla had their first accident where somebody died and everyone had a fit.
Okay, let me just say that that's bull as far as it being autonomous driving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That whole story was bogus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not that I'm going to pay $70,000 for a freaking wind-up car, you know.
And everyone had the media always has a fit. But what kind of struck me was that the Pokemon Go, the number of people who must be walking out in front of traffic.
Yeah.
And the number of people have their phones stolen straight out of their hand. I mean, you've got to think that that's, out of all the things that are of a danger to people in the world with these things.
I have to ask you a question. What was this about? I was talking about a guy wearing cat ears on your radio.
Johnny Christmas.
Johnny
Christmas, right here.
But I was teasing him about wearing cat ears?
Yep.
How come I don't remember that?
I don't know.
Did you guys have me toasted at that point?
We have the archive.
It was really late at night, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was late.
Like, really late.
And you always give me free liquor.
Yeah,
just
true.
How you get me in here.
Yeah.
We don't have any food, though.
No, we don't have any
food. But I got to tell you, if every radio station had a bar right behind the engineer, I mean, radio would be back fast. You people can't see this because they cleverly put the bottles off camera. Hi, folks.
But well, we don't have a liquor license.
Over there,
so.
Well, you need
it's
one,
apple juice.
Wow. What is Kraken?
Oh, it's spiced rum.
Yeah, I don't want that. Give me some of that Maker's Mark. This'll kick the flu's ass. Okay, have you got a clean glass? I know that's a stretch.
I think we probably have one outside. I don't
okay, no. So oh, here's here so here's what we. Oh, you do. Oh my God, they have a glass. Can I have some water also?
Yep.
Yeah, you could. Well, there's only a little bit. Okay, my beer's been taken away by my nurse.
Whiskey's better for you.
No problem. Thank you, nurse. Whatever you say. Okay. Jeez. Is that being live cast?
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
I'm so glad my mother doesn't have an internet connection. Okay. I'm supposed to take a nap until the closing ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
This will help.
So what have you been up to for the last 2 years?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've had a TV show.
Yeah.
Which was number one or number two every night it was on. I had a second TV show, which was the dumbest show I ever did, called Hunting Hitler. Spoiler alert, we did not catch Hitler. But apparently every criminal on the planet watches the History Channel. I was walking through a police precinct outside of Philadelphia, and from the there's a guy in the cage locked up for armed robbery, and he starts going, you're the guy in the black pickup truck. You were hunting Hitler. And the cops look at me, and I say, he's drunk, he's crazy. And we just kept walking through. So I've had two TV shows, both giant hits. I have a radio show called Justice Radio,
cool.
Which I dumped temporarily. I'm going to start it again in September. I'm in two books, Kinky Friedman Murder Mystery, And Elizabeth Greenwood came out with a phenomenal book called Playing Dead about people who fake their deaths.
Oh.
And I'm one of the investigators in it. It's a nonfiction book. I am now editor of the Investigation and Intelligence Library for Pro Bono Press, and we're coming out with 10 books. I'm doing the verification and the intro for all of them. And I have my day job, PI. And I'm now wrapping up a case that's going to actually be two very large cases. One in Philly, which is a rape murder. And in Austin, there's a very old multiple murder of four kids. And we've broken that one. So both of those, you know, very, very satisfying. But both of them have been dragging on for years, and I'm finally finishing them.
How does it feel when you catch something that's been going on that long? Does it feel better?
You know, I don't have the right attitude about these things. I admit that. My problem is I look at the fact that they've been sitting around for years and they could have been solved by anyone. I mean, for somebody to say we had to wait for Steve Rombaugh. Look, I'm a very good investigator. I'm not the only very good investigator. There's a lot of great police investigators, there's a lot of great private eyes, hundreds. I'm one of hundreds. And the idea that a case has to wait for me to stumble along, take it, work it, it's offensive to me. It's offensive. You know, when I was doing the Nazi war crimes stuff,
mm-hmm.
two-thirds of these guys were living under their own names. A third of them I found, honest to God, in the White Pages. I mean, the joke was I went to the Yellow Pages, I looked on the war criminals Nazi. But almost. These guys had such unique names. And of course, once databases started to come out, once there was the first phone disk, and I could put in a name like Kisselitis, which is really unique, it's like, oh, no problem, Nazi. But the idea that these cases had to wait for me to come along is really annoying to me. You know, that I realize that's not the healthy way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these cases, believe me when I tell you, I could give you the case file, you could go and solve it just by common sense. And you have to wonder how many thousands and thousands of people are being denied justice. You know, the more you know, the less you like it.
Fair. That's an interesting point.
But all the stuff like Link New York City and ALPRs and surveillance cameras and data valence and databases and privacy investigation, wonderful aid for investigators.
So if I could ask then, if there are so many crimes that are left uninvestigated, I mean, there must be reasons for that. Then think about something like the Link NYC. You know, some of the common claims are like, oh, well, it will help us reinvestigate crimes or investigate crimes.
No, it will not help you reinvestigate crimes.
Yeah, so
that's ridiculous crap for two reasons. First of all the data is being gathered. Nobody is looking at it. It's only when they're actually looking at the person and they say, let's check to see where he was. They've already got the guy. You know, sometimes, rarely, they'll do a tower dump and they'll see who was in the area of a shooting or something like that. Emphasis on the word rarely. So first of all, it's not helping solve crimes. Second of all, it's a bad trade-off. You F blank blank K a million people to catch one bad guy. It's not how it's supposed to work in America. It's really not.
Yeah, and I mean, I spend a lot of time trying to debunk the idea that, you know, this is going to benefit
people. You're British. You have no clue about any how anything works in this country.
I'm Australian.
Come on. Are you? I love Australia.
Big difference.
I love Australia. All the Australian women look like her, big, good-looking girls. Yeah. I like Australia. I like Bondi Beach, baby.
Yeah, I'm from Sydney originally, actually.
Oh, are you?
So, yeah, very familiar with
Bondi. I love the ferry. I used to purposely have meetings at the Taronga Zoo I was at the reopening of the Sydney Opera House. I was there for Tosca. I mean, I love Sydney. Yeah.
It's one of these things, so I try and bring this message home because there's not a lot of people talking about this stuff over there. In the last year, they introduced this metadata retention law, this idea that we're going to retain the metadata for 2 years.
Is that actually what it's called?
They call it metadata retention. And they, the guy, the Attorney General,
Orwell
is the guy who's meant to be
so
in charge.
Proud.
The guy who's meant to be in charge, like, he was asked on TV one night, what's metadata? He couldn't
and
answer
he
the question.
Right?
So anyway,
it's
try and bring
data
this
that's totally meta.
Yeah. So I try and bring this home and say, you know, listen, the people who, you know, mastered the art of mass surveillance are telling you, well, not quite here, it's worse in Singapore, but they're telling you that it doesn't
work. I doubt
Australia's
really good at it yet, although they are one of the NSA's big partners.
Yes, they are.
The Five Eyes partner.
Yes, they
so
are.
The guys who really know how to be spooks really know how to be spooks. But the guys who are looking at this metadata, I'm sure they're scratching their butts. They don't know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. Like the
you need to bring me over there. I will teach them how to invade your privacy. I will shred your privacy.
First thing I'll start
and
with
I'll
is
do it, and I'll do it just for seafood dinners. I mean, can I tell you my one Australia story?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So at the time that I was first in Australia, I was there for a wedding in Wollongong, and which just the name of the place made me laugh.
That's enough to go to.
I mean, it's not as bad as Toowoomba.
Or Woolloomooloo.
Yeah. But anyway, so I was at Wollongong at a wedding, which was really weird because in America, the bride and the groom come out and the first toast, you know, is to the couple. So this was at a country club in Wollongong, and the best man, who's the groom's brother, stands up and he says, the first toast, to the queen. It's like, what the? I'm an American. We, like, shot these people. So anyway, so my girlfriend at the time and I were checking out of the hotel. It was the best hotel in Sydney at the time, the Hyatt Kingsgate. And we're staying at the top of this hotel and, you know, avoiding all the riffraff, which is like the whole city. And I know I love Sydney, I really do. And we had been to Harbourside, and I had gotten an octopus pasta dinner. And as you know, your octopus is different from our octopus in that you get giant tentacles with suckers. I mean, you get
the
some
Kraken.
Yeah, you get something that looks like, you know, it tried to kill Captain Nemo.
Yeah.
And so I have this in the little mini fridge bar in the hotel. And we're checking out, and I remember that it's there. So I make sure my girlfriend's not watching because she thinks I'm an idiot, and she's right. And I take the tentacles, and I open the toilet, and I put them coming out of the toilet. And I close the toilet, and we check out. Okay, I can't help myself. I do things like this. I'm a moron. I'm like a five-year-old kid. So we go back to America, and this is before the internet and all of that. And we go back to America, and I get a letter from the Hyatt Gold Key program. I'm a frequent idiot at Hyatt. And they say, dear Mr. Rambam, we're shocked you did this. You know, as one of our frequent guests, you know, you freaked out this maid. She ran screaming down the hallway and never returned to our hotel again. Okay. So this is true. So I actually have these letters on the wall of my office. So I wrote them a letter. I said, I'm shocked that you would think I would do such a thing. I have no idea what you're talking about. I can't even believe this actually happened. This must be some trick to try to extort more money out of me. I will never stay in a Hyatt again for the rest of my life. About 3 weeks pass, I get a letter from the manager of the Hyatt Kingsgate. Dear Mr. Rambam, we're so sorry that we made this false allegation. Please accept a one-week certificate for our hotel. So I went back and I stayed in their hotel for free. Okay, if the guy's listening now, I'm toast.
Yeah.
I mean, it was 20-some-odd years ago, so I'm probably, you know, beyond the statute of Hyatt limitations. But yes, and a kangaroo tried to bite my girlfriend. We thought they were these real cuddly little things, and it looked like a weightlifting kangaroo. And she, oh, let me pet the kangaroo. So I now understand that every animal in Australia, its main job is to kill people.
Yeah, yes. You know, like, yeah. 9 out of the 10 most venomous spiders, snakes, anything in the city.
Okay, this is a kangaroo.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this is kind of the spectrum we're looking at. So even the kangaroos are relatively mild compared to that.
I think we're out of time. We have people waiting to get in here.
Well, thank you for joining Steve Rombom's Travelogue, and we'll see you again next week.
All right.